All right, good evening, everyone. So it's wonderful to be back here again with all of you. I don't know what number year this is that I've been privileged to learn with this group, but whatever number it is, it's a privilege to be back. I want to thank Sandy for inviting me back to come and to share some Torah with you. And the truth is, what's nice about this is tonight she really gives us an opportunity to build on what we spoke about last year. Because the truth is, last year my topic was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. But we spoke much more last year about Rav Moshe's life, about Rav Moshe's, really the biographical details of the life of perhaps one of the most important Jewish leaders of the last century. Tonight, our focus is going to be a little bit different, in that tonight we're going to focus on some of the responsa of Rav Moshe Feinstein. So again, just a quick review from last year, although I'm sure you all remember this year from last year. So a quick review. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was born in Uzda, which was a small city near Minsk, which at that point in time was part of the Russian Empire. And Rav Moshe was born on March 3rd, 1895. His father, Rav David Feinstein, was the Rav of Uzda. And of course, again, if you remember, one of the interesting things that happened in Rav Moshe's life was the fact that he ends up becoming the Rav of the very town in which he grew up. Now, interestingly enough, in Jewish tradition, this is a very interesting idea. There's a concept brought down in the Talmud of Ein Navi Be'iro, which means you can't be a prophet in your own city. Why you can't be a prophet in your own city? Because the truth is, when you go back to the place that you grew up in, so everyone knows you from your childhood, and no matter what you accomplish, no matter what you become, no matter what you grow into, you know, everyone knows you as little Moshele. So generally, again, if somebody wants to occupy a leadership position, it's very difficult to do that in the place where they grew up. Of course, it tells us about the incredible esteem in which the people of Uzda held Rav Moshe, that here there was a little boy, a young man, who they knew since he was a little boy, but yet, again, they're willing to accept him as Rav of their town. So, interestingly enough, Rav Moshe studied in yeshivas in Slutsk, in Shklov, and another number of other cities, but the truth is his primary tutelage took place with his father, Rav David Feinstein, which is also interesting because you see this almost as like a hallmark of some of the greatest leaders of the last generation, where although they spend a little bit of time in chadarim and yeshivos in their local cities and in cities far away, their primary education came from their parents. Of course, if you remember, I don't know, it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we spoke about Rav Soloveitchik, and the Rav was no different. The Rav did not really go to yeshiva, per se, which of course sounds interesting for us to say that the Rav didn't go to yeshiva. The Rav went to cheder for a little while when he was a little boy. But if you remember again from our Rav Soloveitchik shir, his days in cheder were quite limited, especially after his father found out that the Chabad Malamed was not teaching the boys Gemara, but he was teaching the boys Tanya. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, remember, I think I shared this story with you, just as an aside. So the Rav writes that he remembers from his childhood, so he had in Chaslovich, in White Russia, so he had a wonderful Rebbe in his cheder, a Chabad Malamed, and the Rav said that the Malamed was wonderful, except the Rav felt, even as a little boy, he really didn't know how to learn all that much Gemara. The Malamed didn't know how to learn so much Gemara, but he taught them Tanya. So, of course, those of you that are familiar a little bit with Chabad Chasidus, so Tanya, which is the lifeblood of the Lubavitch movement, an incredibly important work, not just for Lubavitch, but for all streams of Chasidus, written by Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. So the Malamed used to go ahead and teach them Tanya. So, of course, this was not sanctioned by the Rav of the city, who was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's father. So what the Malamed used to do is he used to post one of the boys at the doorway of the cheder. And when they saw Rav Moshe Soloveitchik coming, the Malamed would say, quickly, close up your Tanyas, take out your Gemaras. And the Rav says, as a little boy, I remember that the Malamed would just tell us, just yell. Because, you know, if you ever go into a base medrash, so you hear like a lot of yelling, and it's like a whole cacophony of noise. So just yell, because if you yell, if you say it out loud, it sounds like you're really into it. So, okay, this went on for a little while until Rav Moshe Soloveitchik took his young son Yosef Tov to meet his grandfather of Chaim Soloveitchik. And of course, again, so what does the Zayda ask the Yenikel? You know, what does he ask his young grandson when he sees him? What are you learning? He says, oh, I'm learning Bav Metzia. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik begins to test him on Bav Metzia, and he realizes that young Yosef Dov does not know one word of Bav Metzia. So his grandfather was upset. So young little Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik says to his grandfather, Zayda, don't be upset. I don't know Bava Metzia, but I can quote you three chapters of Tanya by heart. So Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik were not very happy with that. So they, at that point in time, the Malamed, I believe, lost his job in Chaslovich and was replaced by someone else. But more importantly, that's where Rav Moshe Soloveitchik also realized that if his son was going to grow to be a great Torah leader, his father, Rav Moshe, was going to have to assume the responsibility for his education. The Rav really doesn't go to any other yeshivas but learns with his father. And Rav Moshe was really no different. Rav Moshe spent a little bit more time. And you know, again, remember, Rav Moshe and the Rav are cousins. We're cousins. That, remember, the Rav's maternal grandfather was a Feinstein. Interestingly enough. So also, Rav Moshe, same idea. Rav Moshe spent a little bit more time in yeshivos than his cousin, the Rav. But really, the majority of his education ultimately comes from his father. The Rav moves to New York City in 1936. And again, as we spoke about last time, when we spoke about Rav Moshe's life, the Rav left Russia very begrudgingly, for one simple reason, not because he had any great love for Russia, but because he had an incredibly great love for his kehila, for his community. And although it was clear that the writing was on the wall, so what was going to happen in Russia, what was going to happen to the Jewish communities throughout Eastern Europe, the Rav felt such an incredible allegiance, until finally there was such incredible familial pressure, as well as communal pressure, meaning the Rav's own community, Rav Moshe's own community, urged him to leave. So he comes to the United States in 1936, settles in the Lower East Side, where he remains until the end of his life. The Rav, of course, his official position was that he was Rosh Yeshiva of Misifta Teferes Yerushalayim, which was his yeshiva that he started on the Lower East Side. But of course, Rav Moshe was much more than just a Rosh Yeshiva of a particular yeshiva. Rav Moshe was a leader for all of Klal Yisrael. And this is going to be very important as we go through some of our tshuvas, our responsa tonight, that Rav Moshe truly felt a responsibility towards all Jews. He truly was a manig. He truly was a leader in that sense. You know, it's interesting. The Medrash brings down that if you look at the history of all of our virtually all of our leaders throughout the Chumash. So if you look at Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, if you look at Moshe, so they all have one very striking thing in common. And even if you look at David HaMelech, how did they all begin their careers? Shepherds, right? They all started as shepherds. So it's interesting, you know, the Baal Shem Tov writes, he says, so why is that? You might ever wonder about that. Why is that? That all the Avos, the patriarchs, David HaMelech, again, Shlomo didn't because Shlomo grew up and is part of royalty. But so many leaders throughout Tanakh began as, Dr. Miller, can you go? So many leaders began as shepherds. So the Baal Shem Tov has a beautiful explanation. He says, because what happens with shepherding? So with shepherding is you have a bunch of different sheep. And some want to go fast, and some want to go slow, and some want to go right, and some want to go left, and some want to drink, and some don't want to drink. And what's the job of the shepherd? The job of the shepherd is to keep the flock together. The shepherd doesn't say, I'll go with the fast sheep and leave the slow sheep behind. The shepherd doesn't say, I'll take the ones to the left but forget about the ones to the right. The shepherd realizes, my achrayis, my responsibility is for the entire flock. And that's what the Baal Shem Tov writes, that it's not by coincidence that some of our greatest leaders in Tanakh begin as shepherds. They have to learn, and it's most acute by Moshe Rabbeinu, because again, Moshe Rabbeinu was the leader of the flock, and let's be honest, we are a very difficult flock. We go in all different kinds of directions, and so again, for someone, I'm part of that flock, so I could say that. So again, for a leader to be a leader, the leader has to try to control all segments of the flock and to try to hopefully direct them all at their own pace towards one unified national goal. And in that sense, Rav Moshe truly was a manig. Rav Moshe truly was an individual who was just an incredible, not just posek, not just halachic decisor, not just Rosh Yeshiva, but a true manig, a true leader. So there's much more to say about Rav Moshe's biography, but the truth is we really spent last time dealing with that. So hopefully you remember some of that from last time. So tonight what I want to focus on, just for a little bit, is some of Rav Moshe's tshuvas. Now, you understand, of course, that in the course of one class, it's impossible for us to get the true, you know, breadth of Rav Moshe's tshuvas. Rav Moshe was to say that Ramosha was brilliant, so the truth is, doesn't do it justice, because Ramosha was able to absorb and retain information in a way that's just, at least for me as a regular person, beyond comprehension. And Ramosha was also a prolific writer, meaning not per se a literary writer, but again, a writer of responsa. So you know, for example, that Igros Moshe, which is Ramosha's seminal work, literally the letters of Moshe, is 6 volumes. It's actually, now it's already up to 7 volumes, because there was certain correspondence that was published after Rav Moshe's death. And if you look, you know, it's interesting, Ashkenazic and Sephardic poskim are very different in their literary style. So for example, if you try to sit down and learn Rav Moshe's tshuvas, so you should clear your schedule, because generally they're long. And again, it's clear the whole way through, but you know, sometimes, you know, if you're looking at a halachic responsa, so you see the question, so what would you do next if it's very long, you don't have a lot of time? You would assume, look at the last paragraph, right? Rav Moshe does not write that way. Again, I don't know if that's just by design or just whatever, but Rav Moshe, and we'll see some examples of this, where Rav Moshe has a very long tshuva, and literally the answer to the actual question is nestled somewhere in the middle. You know, there's not an asterisk, it's not underlined, it's not bolded. I want to contrast this because, for example, if you've ever, I don't know what other, who else you're covering over this particular course. I don't know if you're talking about any of the responsa of Chacham, of Rav Avadji Yosef. Is that being covered? Not yet. Okay. So if you ever read through Rav Avadji Yosef's tshuvas, so Rav Avadji Yosef writes totally differently. In fact, where Rav Avadji Yosef writes is he might have a very long tshuva, but at the end, he always has a sikum. He always has a summary, which of course is one, and again, that seems to be the hallmark of many Sephardic halachic poskim, many Sephardic halachic decisors. I don't know why stylistically it developed differently, but so again, just Rav Moshe has a style of his own. Rav Moshe takes, the exciting part about learning Rav Moshe's tshuvas is you feel like you're on a journey. You begin with a question, and because Rav Moshe, remember, when somebody asked Rav Moshe a question, so you could have very easily gone ahead and say, okay, Rabbi Feinstein, can I do X? And he could have done what? Yes, no. But the amazing part was Rav Moshe was truly a master teacher in that if somebody was asking a halachic question, he wanted to explain how he arrived at his particular answer. And that was important because, as we'll see, Rav Moshe did issue some, I'm not going to say controversial piske halacha, controversial halachic rulings, but more like innovative, groundbreaking halachic rulings. But even in things that were not so innovative or groundbreaking, Rav Moshe always had an incredible respect for the person who was asking the question, and therefore did not want to just simply give a yes or a no, even though, again, Rav Moshe's yes or Rav Moshe's no would have been fine, but he walks through the entire process. What's also amazing, of course, is that when you read through Rav Moshe's tshuvas, you get a window into Rav Moshe's mind and into his thought process. And it all unfolds very clearly right in front of you in the tshuvas. So let me share with you a couple of very interesting, just to give you, my goal tonight is just to kind of give you a sampling of some of Rav Moshe's tshuvas, some of his interesting halachic positions. And I think also what's important from these tshuvas is when you read Rav Moshe's responsa, you also get a clear understanding of Rav Moshe as an individual. So take a look at number one. So this is an exceptionally important tshuva. So if you look over here, the title, remember each tshuva, and this you'll find in most responsa, is you'll have the question, the subject of the particular question, the subject of the response of the tshuva. Kvias eis hamavis. So this, of course, is an exceptionally important idea. And this, I want to tell you, I'm starting out with the good stuff first. I'm not going to make you wait. This is perhaps one of Rav Moshe's most controversial tshuvas. And the reason why it's also controversial is we'll see, because Rav Moshe in other places also contradicts himself. Remember that Igros Moshe, which is the compilation of Rav Moshe's tshuvas, his responsa, spans decades. Decades. So you could have a tshuva that Rav Moshe wrote, you know, in 1950, and another one that he wrote in 1975. And especially when dealing with different topics, where let's say, we'll deal with, let's say, with certain medical ethics issues, where medicine or science certainly medicine science changes by the day. It certainly changes over the course of two decades. So Rav Moshe sometimes will say things in two different tshuvas, but the reader is left wondering, is he contradicting himself or is he adopting a new approach based on new realities? For example, I didn't put this on here. Rav Moshe Paskind, that back in 19, I think it was 19, the first heart transplant was conducted in 1975. Does that sound correct? Any doctors here? Earlier? The first successful one where someone lived. They did a couple earlier, but I think the first successful one was in 1970. It was in South Africa, correct. 1968? Okay. So interestingly enough, Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he writes that heart transplant is usur, that you cannot engage in heart transplantation. Now, when Rav Moshe wrote that tshuva, I think it must have been the late 60s, maybe early 70s, when the process itself was new, and again, the potential to survive the operation was quite low. So Rav Moshe Paskin, you shouldn't do it. You shouldn't do it. But again, obviously, that was reflected. If somebody were to ask Rav Moshe today, if Moshe was alive, can I do a heart transplant? I would venture, not Rabbi Feinstein, but I would venture to say that Rav Moshe would not paskin today, the same thing that he paskin in the late 60s, early 70s. So this is just important because sometimes you'll hear that Rabbi Feinstein said this about medical ethics and that about medical ethics. And it's true, there are different tshuvas and there are different approaches and different stances because they were also given at different times. So for example, this tshuva here is kvias eis hamaves, determining the end of life, determining the moment of death. And you can see this tshuva over here is from 1976. So we're not going to do all of this. I'm really just, I put a lot more on these sheets than what we're going to cover. But of course, they're yours. You could look at them on your own. But look what he writes. He writes in 1 Aleph, Hine, Bidavar Yidias Misas Ha'adam Mefurish Bigimar Yuma, Daf Pehei Amad Aleph, Benofa Ma'poles Ala Adam, Shemefachin Es Hagal Afilo B'Shabis, Ubotkin Ad Chotmo. Now, in general, the halachic discussion about determining death is a raging debate. It's a raging debate that was a raging debate in times of the Talmud, and it's a raging debate to this very day. Of course, again, there are two formal schools of thought. So one, again, adopts the approach of cardiac death, the cessation of the beating of the heart, and one is, again, failure or inability for spontaneous respiration. You can't breathe on your own, which today we call brain death. Because again, once the brainstem stops working, so brainstem controls spontaneous respiration, once the brainstem is gone, ultimately again, no breathing on one's own. So the Gemara actually discusses this. And the Gemara discusses, again, a pile of rubble fell on an individual. You're clearing off the rubble on Shabbos, and you need to figure out what can you do or what should you do for this individual who's trapped. So the Gemara says, quoting at least one approach, that ubotkin ad chotmo, you uncover the person until their nose. In other words, what are you looking for? You're looking for breathing. Are they breathing or not? The if sikin b'gemara perek beiz mishabes halacha yotes ubeshulchan arach arachaim simin shinchav tes sif dalid shim lo hir gushu shum chius hu bedin meis shu bebedikas hanashima. So Rav Moshe, what we see from this Gemara is that the definition of death is the absence of spontaneous respiration. Once a person is not breathing, then they are halachically considered dead. And it's interesting. He says, "Sha'afim hanashima kal, bless you. Sha'afim hanashima kala ma'od. Even if breathing is very light, nami hu bedin chai, a person is still considered alive. Sheroen zeh, listen to this. Ayidei notza." How do they used to check if a person was breathing or not? You take a thin piece of paper, you put it under the person's nose. If it moves, then they're breathing. If it doesn't move, then they're not breathing. So Rav Moshe in letter Bays discussed. Now again, obviously, this has ramifications on many levels. This has ramifications, first of all, Let's see letter Beis, just one line in Beis, and then we'll skip down to Gimel. He says, "Zeu b'stam cholin shenikrav matzavam lemisa v'lo hutzichu lemachona shiazin linshom." So Rav Moshe says, obviously, the case of the Gemara, someone had a traumatic event. They're significantly injured, and we're trying to see if they're alive or not. Rav Moshe in letter Beis then goes on to discuss about what if someone is on a ventilator? What if someone is breathing, but they are breathing because of artificial means? So then, are you permitted to take them off the ventilator? So just to tell you something interesting. So Rav Moshe suggests you cannot remove someone from life support. You cannot remove someone from a ventilator. So Rav Moshe gives an interesting approach. Rav Moshe says, but everyone knows that they have to change out the oxygen, what do you call it?
Tanks.
Thank you. They have to change out the oxygen tanks. And so again, that when they have to change out the oxygen tanks, that's when you can see if the person could breathe on their own. If they could breathe on their own, but with difficulty, then you have to put them back on the respirator. But if they can't breathe at all, the Moshe says the person effectively is no longer alive, and you need not reconnect them. Of course, again, this is also dated because today, again. Exactly. Today it's attached right to a constant flow of oxygen. So, of course, there is really no interval. There's no time where the tanks run out and you have this interval where a person is not hooked up to the respirator. So look at letter Gimel. Aval zehu be'inchi shenachlu b'dei shemayim be'iza machle shehi. So Moshe says, but even the idea of disconnecting someone from a respirator, so what happens? That's someone, that case, we were talking about someone who was sick, nebach, old age, or some other kind of condition. However, what happens if somebody was injured, betunas drachim, and he writes in parentheses, be'accident al yedei hakars. Okay, that's right, that's Yiddish or Hebrew, whatever, right? Car accident. Now you see what Rav Moshe va'ayidei nefila mechalonos u'kidome she'ira she'ayidei hiskaftus ha'atzavam be'izem akomos asmucham la'areo or l'klei aneshima enam yecholim limshom. So Rav Moshe is talking about a car accident because he's talking about essentially a traumatic brain injury. Someone suffers a traumatic brain injury and they are unable to breathe on their own. Ukishiyavar izes man shinashmu afrak aydia machuna hamachone yispashtu mekomos hanichvatzi viaschilu limshom baatzmam she'elu af she'en yecholim limshom baatzmam v'gam lo nikarim bohem inyanei chiyus acherim efshar she'enam adayim meisim. Because Rav Moshe says there are some people where you need to hook them up to the ventilator, to the respirator, in order for them to regain their strength. And a person like that, if you just help them out, if you let the body, if you allow the body to not exert itself as much, that will enable the healing process to take place, and a person will be able, bless you, over time, to be able to breathe on their own. Look at the underlying lines in letter Gimel. V'cheivan sha'ata omer, sha'ata ika nisayon, sherofim gedolim yecholim levarer, al yedei zrikas eza lachluchis baguf, al yedei agidim, Leida shenifsak hakesher sheyesh la moach im kol haguf. So he says, but now that I heard that there are tests that can be done, right? There's some iodine tests or radioactive isotopes that you could inject, and you could see based on the flow if there's any kind of brain activity. So now that I've heard that they have these kind of tests, now you also have to understand something. And this is also something very interesting in general about poskim. In general, in life, you're only as accurate as the information you receive. And therefore, again, a lot of times things come up where, now again, interestingly enough, who did Rav Moshe rely on very heavily for medical information? His son-in-law, Rav Moshe David Tendler. Now, Rav Moshe David Tendler, again, himself, I don't know if he's an MD or a PhD, or maybe he's an MD? PhD, but I think he's a PhD in like biology. Right, so he's an individual, knows a lot, and Rav Moshe got out. Now, the reason why I'm saying this is because Rabbi Tendler, as we'll see, had his own agenda, not agenda in a bad way, but had his own halachic position, and many feel that perhaps Rav Moshe was influenced, where Rav Moshe writes over here, was influenced by that. Just to pause here for just a moment, just to give you an example of this. So someone asked Rav Moshe, now we're going to go literally from one extreme to the other extreme. You know, we're talking now about establishing death. Another very, very important issue within halachic Judaism that someone asked Rav Moshe is, do you have to wash on a slice of pizza? Okay, these are major issues. Do you have to wash on pizza? So Rav Moshe paskind, no, you don't have to wash on pizza. Why? Because Rav Moshe said, because people don't eat it as a meal. It's a snack. Now, I would venture to say that Mrs. Feinstein did not call her husband during the weekend and say, listen, Moshe, Good news, we're ordering in tonight, right? So what does Rav Moshe know about pizza? Rav Moshe knows about pizza, whatever somebody told him about pizza. So whoever he asked, someone told him, nobody eats pizza as a meal. People eat pizza as a snack. But again, I don't know, maybe people still consider pizza a snack, but I think many people still consider pizza. So had Rav Moshe been told, for example, that no, pizza is a meal, people eat it as a meal, so I would assume that Rav Moshe would have said, of course, what is pizza? It's a piece of bread with cheese on top of it. Why is it any different than having a piece of bread with cheese on top of it? Of course you wash. Of course you make hamotzi. So we're going from one extreme to the other, but I'm just pointing out how, in general, a halachic decisor is only going to be able to paskin based on the information they receive. So here Rav Moshe says, I know that there are tests that could go ahead and determine brain activity. He says, let's go on a little bit. She'im lo yavo ze la'amoach, if this dye does not reach the brainstem, hu barer she'im la'amoach shum shaychos la'haguf. It is clear that the brainstem, the brain, no longer has any connection to the body. V'gam shekvar nirkav ha'moach legamrei. Now, this is a very controversial statement. And Moshe says, once there is no brain activity, the brain essentially totally decays. The brain totally decays. It just turns into mush. It decays. V'havi kihutas harosh bekoach. And Rav Moshe says, essentially, once the brain is no longer working, it's totally decayed, and therefore it's as if what? It's as if a person's been decapitated. Now, if a person's been decapitated, is there any machlokus about whether or not they're alive or dead? I think most opinions will hold, right? That obviously they're dead. So Rav Moshe holds that if you could demonstrate, and again, Rav Moshe also discusses elsewhere about whether or not the Harvard criteria, because, you know, again, the whole criteria that we operate presently with today for brain death is based on what we call 5 points made by the Harvard criteria. Now, that's not necessarily enough halachically to determine brain death, but Rav Moshe understood those criteria. He was told those criteria. So Rav Moshe says again that if the brain's not working, it's as if the brain has decayed, nirkav legamrei, and it's as if a person has been decapitated. She'im kein, yesh lano lahachmir be'elu, af she'ino margish kvar beklum, af alo ayidei dekiras machat, va'af she'ino no shem klal below hamachuna, sh'yachlitu shumis achiasu b'digazu. Now, what Rav Moshe points out over here is, one of the things they do for the Harvard criteria is they do the pin test, right? That if they prick the person and there's absolutely no reflexive reaction, that's also one of the telltale signs of brain death. So Rav Moshe writes, but we don't rely on any of these things without the test. You have to do the test to make sure that there's absolutely no brain activity. Only after you do this test that he's describing, that there is no connection between the brain and the body, then you can make the determination that ultimately, again, the person is no longer alive. So, here you have Rav Moshe seemingly paskening that brain death is an appropriate halachic criteria for end of life. Now understand, of course, this dispute, this major dispute in terms of definition of time of death within halachic Judaism, is a major dispute that has many, many ramifications. It has ramifications in terms of organ transplant. Let's assume for a moment that organ transplant is permitted. That by itself is subject to much incredible dispute as well. But remember, organ transplant is only a discussion of what? Right? If you subscribe to a brain death criteria. Because the truth is, remember, if you go by a cardiac death criteria, heart stops pumping, there's no blood flow anymore, you can't harvest most organs after that. The only way you could harvest organs is if you subscribe to a brain, because again, remember, that means the heart, the person could be brain dead, but the heart could still be pumping blood. So you could go ahead and you could get a lot of organs of such an individual. So this has major ramifications. Withdrawal of life support. So again, if you accept the brain death criteria, that means as soon as you go ahead and you prove that a person is brain dead, you can take them off life support, because at that point in time the person is halachically dead, as opposed to if you take the approach of a cardiac death, we'll call definition, then it's much more difficult to remove people from life support. So it appears that Rav Moshe here takes the position that in fact brain death is the halachic definition of death. Only one problem, whereas Rav Moshe states in two other places that the definition of death is the cessation of the heart beating. Only once the heart stops beating, that is the definition of death. Now, to point out something very interesting to you. So Rabbi J. David Bleich, is probably the chief antagonist of Rav Moshe David Tendler. So Rav Tendler said, you see, the Shver, my father-in-law, remember, Rav Moshe was his father-in-law, said that brain death is an appropriate halachic definition for end of life. So Rabbi Bleich countered, he said, Rav Moshe was not clear on the facts. Whoever was giving him the information either left something, because Rabbi Bleich sees on something very interesting. Rabbi Bleich says that Rav Moshe says that once the brain no longer functions, then nirkav hamoach legamrei. The brain totally decays. Now, we know scientifically that is not true. That is not true. Now, over time, the brain will decay, but a person could be brain dead and the brain did not decay, meaning the brain matter is still there and still intact. So Rabbi Bleich argues on part of Ramosha's premise. So again, this is not a shiur tonight. It's not a lecture tonight on the halachic definition of death. I'm just pointing out to you, this is Ramosha's premise, one of Ramosha's most famous tshuvas, one of his most famous halachic responsa. And the interesting thing about Rav Moshe is that both camps, we'll call them the brain death camp and the cardiac death camp, both claim Rav Moshe as their posek, right? They both claim that Rav Moshe ultimately, again, supported their position. Yes? So it's an excellent question. So there are a total of, I think, about four different responsa that Rav Moshe spoke about on this particular topic, and the interesting part is they're all right around the same time, which is quite fascinating. So whereas normally if Rav Moshe wrote something in 1950 and then wrote something again in 1975, so generally you would assume that that which is written 2.5 decades later, that's the problem now is you have a number of tshuvas all around the same period of time. That's where we have the ambiguity. So again, so this is just piece number one. Again, like I said, we could do a whole series on this of end of life, which is quite interesting. But I'm just pointing out that here, Rav Moshe's Psak Halacha, so really, really molded Jewish thinking in this particular area. But amazing enough, molded Jewish thinking in two radically different directions. Molded Jewish thinking that brain death is a proper definition of death, and molded Jewish thinking that cardiac death is a proper definition of death as well. Let me show, yes, question? Yes, so you could see over here, I'm sorry, I should have read that part. If you go back to number one, look at the first line, it's in smaller print. Kvias eis hamavas be'ezras Hashem yisparach he'iyar tafshin lamid vav me'eis chosni hanechbad va'ahuv lanu from my beloved son-in-law, Harav Moshe David Tendler Shlita. So this was Rav Moshe David Tendler posing this question to his father-in-law. And again, remember, Rabbi Tendler was doing it, just to be clear, not because he had, let's say, an acute case in front of him. Rabbi Tendler was asking his father-in-law with the hope that Rav Moshe would set halachic policy. Not that Rav Moshe's word was the final word on things. As we'll see, many times other poskim, other halachic opinions disagree with him. But if Rav Moshe were to come out conclusively, it certainly would carry a lot of weight. Let me show you something else that's interesting. Look at number two. So here's another tshuva by Rav Moshe. And what's interesting is a lot of Rav Moshe's tshuvas, a lot of his responsa that deal with medical ethics, have incredible relevance. So look at this tshuva over here, and you'll see why this is contemporarily relevant. So he writes, Shnei cholim, if you have two sick people in front of you, she'echad tzorich l'ripui bevadai, v'urak l'chayisha. One person is very ill, and he definitely needs to be treated, but what does chayisha mean? Very limited time. He has a terminal illness. He's going to die. He's not going to recover. But he presents with certain acute symptoms or certain acute issues, which you can remedy now. So you cannot heal him. You cannot address the more global issue. You cannot make him better. But you could address whatever the current circumstances are at this moment. V'hasheni, safek im tzarech l'ripoy zeh, aval yecholin l'raposo. Then you have a second person who's ill. Now this person, you're not exactly sure what he needs exactly, but one thing is clear, which is even worst case scenario, whatever he needs, you can give him and you could heal him. So what's the question? Triage care. Limited resources. Who gets the resources? And just, of course, all of us know that this is so incredibly contemporarily relevant, because now, again, in our current healthcare climate, this is the direction that we are definitely heading towards. So the triage, who, limited resources, who gets the care? You know, it's interesting to understand this also has other ramifications, because, you know, it's fascinating to see that, you know, when hospitals treat people, so it's not just about getting reimbursed for services rendered, it's also about showing particular results, right? Funding very often is tied in to your ability to heal illness. So you could be the most wonderful physician, the most wonderful hospital, right, the most wonderful institution, but if you can't show numbers, right, that you are healing X number of people, getting X number of people, so that, of course, could lead to reduced funding. So this idea of triage care, now that's not Rav Moshe's talking about over here. Rav Moshe's asking a very interesting halachic question. Two people in front of you, one bed. One bed. One person is sick, but they're going to die. You could heal them now for a little bit, make them better for a little bit, but they're going to die. Second person, we're not exactly sure what it is that they need, but whatever it is, we're pretty confident. Worst case, no, we could heal them. Who gets the bed? Look what Rav Moshe writes in paragraph Beis. Ubedavar shnei cholim. When it comes to two people who are ill, echad shelefi umdina darofim who rak ripoy lechayisha laharich yomav b'masha efshalahem. So one person who is terminally ill, and the most you could do is perhaps extend his life for a couple of days. Ulepamim who rak lesalik mina hayisurin avat zerch letipol nimrats. Or maybe you can't even extend his life, but you know what you can do? Comfort care. You can go in and you can make sure that the person is comfortable, the person is not suffering. V'hasheni, the other patient, on the other hand, lefi umdina shelahem, according to the assessment of the doctors, yecholim l'rafoso, aval in yadu alahem im yitztarich letipol nimratz kazeh, sha'osim b'veis ha'cholim b'yechida, letipol nimratz. He writes over here, emergency room. Right? What is it? So what is Moshe saying? There's one bed in the emergency room. There's one bed. Two people show up, and the question, again, of course, we want to treat everyone, but let's say I can't. Or you know where this comes up more often, let's say, again, there's one respirator, right? Or there's one, you could fill in the blank however you want. The point is, two people come, one is terminally ill and going to die, but you could address some of his issues, you could take away some of the pain. The other person definitely has an incredible possibility for healing, for survival. Who gets the resources? Look at Rav Moshe writes, paragraph Gimel. So this is just very interesting. Hinei nir la'ani as daiti would appear to me, she'im ba'oshtim b'vasachas. So Rav Moshe, of course, says, you know, again, the first thing we do is we try to deconstruct and look at this in concrete cases. So what's happening? If both of them show up at the hospital at the same time, we'll call them Reuven and Shimon, they both show up at the same time, haynu kodim shechnisu ha'echad mehem, tzarech lahachnis betchila es mishel adas harofim, hanimtsayim shem yichol nirafoso, im gam lechol ezeh tzarech lahaschil tekev im yishtzorech af nisafek. So Moshe, if they both show up at the same time, literally, they show up at the same time, which means no one has any more entitlement than the other, then what? Then you take the individual whom you feel you can cure. Then you treat the individual whom you feel you can go ahead and restore them back to health. That's the person you treat. But he goes on. Paragraph Dalit. However, now once Rav Moshe says that, then the other cases become clear as well. V'im kvar hechnisu shames achola sheladatam urak lechayisha ein motzin oso misham. But if you already began to treat the first patient, we'll call him the terminal patient, once he has acquired that right of treatment, you can't what? You can't take it away and reallocate it to someone else. So this is really fascinating. So if they both show up at the same time, so meaning they both are equally entitled, we take the one that has the greater probability for survivability. That's, we give him the treatment. But if you've already begun to treat the terminally ill person, even though you know, again, you're not going to change his outcome, but he has acquired that right to those services, you cannot deprive him of them in order to give them to someone else. Look what he writes. Skip down a little bit. He says, look at paragraph Vav. Aval hu dafka ba'ofen shelo yada ha'chola ha'masukan shelefi umdunos harofim I efshal raposo dim al yidei zeh yodei she'efshal raposo hari yisba'is shebishvil zeh Yeshlochu sheyakriv misaso v'yitrov dato she'asa b'chol. I'm just going to read two more lines, then I'll explain. Umachma sheyoseh matzah she'ini odeh matzavo dehaz hirmi legaloslo v'gam asa legaloslo l'chein yesh lahaktim lachniso l'chidar yechida l'misha batchila. So Moshe says something amazing. Now, so Moshe gives two cases, and this is also so reflective, again, of differences in thinking. So Moshe's, remember, both of them show up at the same time. Who gets the treatment? The one you feel that has the greater probability of survivability. He gets the treatment. If the terminally ill patient comes first and you're treating him, you have to continue to give it to him. So Moshe says, but you have to be careful. Listen to this. And this is, and we're going to see this over and over and over again, that the mark, that, you know, there's a difference between being a scholar and being a leader. Being a scholar means you have a lot of information. It says nothing about your character. It says nothing about your moral compass. And the truth is, you can be an incredible scholar and not care one bit about people. Being a leader means you have the knowledge, but your knowledge is laced with compassion and laced with empathy. So Moshe says, here's where you have to be careful. Because I know that I told you before that if they both show up at the same time, you give the treatment to the one who has the greater probability of survivability. But you have to make sure that the other patient doesn't feel that you've now just handed him a death sentence. Because if he feels that you have essentially said, well, sorry, you know, your time is limited anyway, you know, feel free to make yourself comfortable in the waiting room. You know, if that's the message you're giving him, then says Rav Moshe, you could expedite and potentially accelerate his death, which of course is awesome. Now, Rav Moshe is something amazing. Rav Moshe, and this is also reflective, I didn't include the date of this tshuva, so I don't remember offhand when this was, but listen to what Rav Moshe says. Rav Moshe says, but generally, if a person is terminal, Rav Moshe writes, generally the doctors don't tell them the full scope of their condition, and generally they're not fully knowledgeable. Now understand that there's been an incredible shift of thinking in the way we deal with terminal illness. Again, like, I have to go back and look at the date, but Rav Moshe is making the assumption that the terminal patient is not fully in the know about what's happening with them. So if Reuven and Shimon show up at the same time and Reuven is terminal and Shimon is not going to take in Shimon, so Reuven is not going to read into that all that much. But says Rav Moshe, if when Reuven and Shimon show up and you take in Shimon, and Reuven is going to say, oh my gosh, they've essentially just told me that I'm a dead man. They've just told me that, again, there's no point in even putting any resources into me. You have to measure the damage that could have on Reuven. And Rav Moshe says you have to act accordingly. Now, Rav Moshe doesn't tell you what to do in that situation. Because remember, again, now we have a conflict. Because Rav Moshe told me when Reuven and Shimon show up at the same time, and Reuven can be healed. Oh, actually, I'm switching things around. Reuven is terminal, and Shimon can be healed. So Rav Moshe said, treat Shimon, and don't treat Reuven. That's assuming Reuven doesn't read into that decision. But if Reuven reads into that decision, essentially what Rav Moshe says is, okay, you got to figure that one out. You just have to, I can't script that for you, but some way, somehow, you have to figure out how, on one hand, to go ahead and treat Shimon, on the other hand, again, not convey a message of hopelessness to Reuven. So again, quite interesting. And obviously, a tshuva like this, is so contemporarily relevant in terms of triage care and in terms of allocation of scarce resources. Who gets the resources? Yes. You can't take it away from Reuven once he has it. You cannot take it away. Once Reuven has that, right? And again, remember, that halachic principle is a simple one, which is that when a person is alive, what my life, if Reuven's the terminal patient, and the fact that he's terminal doesn't make his moments of life any less important than Shimon's. So if Reuven is already on the respirator, we have absolutely no right to save Shimon's life by ending Reuven's. That is halachically, we're the same way, by the way, just interestingly enough, that although we're permitted to violate virtually all the precepts of the Torah to go ahead and save our lives, three things we can't do, one of which is murder. Why? Because if somebody, God forbid, says to me, you know, either I have to kill Reuven or the person is going to kill me, I have to allow myself to be killed because my life is no more important than Reuven's life. So I can't save my life at the expense of someone else. So although Reuven is the terminal patient, once he's on it, his life is no less important than Shimon's. So that is, and again, that comes often in conflict with contemporary thought very often. But from a Judaic, from a halachic perspective, again, you have the right to allocate when the playing field is even. So they both show up at the same time, then you have the right to allocate. But once one of them has the services already, you can't deprive one in order to give it to the other. Yes?
But what if you're then sentencing Shimon, who could live and live a normal life, to death?
Well, I'm not sentencing anyone. I can't do anything. I'm not actively doing anything. I can't go. There's nothing I can do. My hands are tied. Because I'm not, so you could reverse that. What right do I have to sentence Reuven to death in order to save Shimon?
Because Shimon could live a normal life and Reuven is...
But the assumption you're making is the fact that Reuven, since Reuven is terminally ill, therefore his final days or weeks or whatever are less important than the years that Shimon could live. And in Jewish law, we do not make that distinction. Life is life is life, whether it's a life of 2 days or if it's a life of 20 years. So I have no right to take Shimon's 2 days in order to give Reuven, excuse me, I have no right to take Reuven's 2 days in order to give Shimon 20 years.
And we stop at that.
Yeah, and the truth is, I just want to point out, this actually is not like, this is not a controversial, because the truth is, this actually is pretty accepted within halachic thought, that again, essentially because we never allow the saving of one life at the expense of another. The only exception to this rule, by the way, the only exception to this rule about saving one life at the expense of another, of course, is the din of rodef, where one person is pursuing another, let's say with the intention to kill them, then you're permitted to kill the pursuer in order to go ahead and save the other individual, which of course has contemporary application in situations of, you know, Rahmanul Itzlan, you know, pregnancies, where let's say the life of the mother is at risk. So halacha absolutely not only sanctions, but obligates for the mother to abort the pregnancy because essentially we view the baby as a rodef. It sounds like a strange thing to say, but the baby is considered to be in pursuit of the mother, and therefore permitted to save the mother's life by terminating the pregnancy. But other than that, even though you're right, it seems like such an unbalanced equation, right? I'm giving Reuven 5 days at the expense of Shimon's 5 years, but the halacha says again, remember, I want to be clear, if the playing field is even and they both walk into the door at the same time, yes, then I have the right to make that call. Because remember, in that case, I'm automatically giving it to one and depriving it to another. That's just the reality of my decision. Once I'm doing that, I should give it to the one who has the greatest probability of survivability. But once one of them has it, I cannot go ahead and take from one and give to the other. Yes?
In Moshe, any place, comment on
it, instead of Reuven and Tyro? So that's an excellent question. So Rav Moshe, I don't know if Rav Moshe explicitly discusses that, but in other situations of medical ethics, Rav Moshe says that we cannot distinguish, you know, there's what the halacha is in a vacuum and what the halacha is in reality. And in reality, because we are part of greater society, we cannot distinguish between Jew and non-Jew in these situations. Not because, honestly, halachically, you might be able to construct an argument that might allow for that, but realistically, you cannot, because as part of greater society, we have to place equal value on all lives. It's the same way we'll see, we're not going to get to it tonight, but where Moshe discusses what doctors are allowed to do or not allowed to do on Shabbos. So Moshe discusses that there is no distinction between treating a Jewish patient or a Gentile patient. Whatever the doctor could do for the Jew, he's permitted to do for the non-Jew as well. So let me show you a couple of other interests. So these were both in the medical ethics topic. Let me show you something very interesting. If you turn to page 4. So here I quoted for you also one of Moshe's perhaps more famous tshuvas. And I guess they're all famous. So here you could see sort of Moshe's writing this. This is in Tav Shin Lamed Ches, 1978. So this is on page 4. So if you see where the letter A is? So this is in Orachayim, This is in Arach Chaim. And again, I Xeroxed this tree from the Igros Moshe itself so you could see just, I told you before at the beginning of the shiur about the incredible length and breadth and depth of Rav Moshe's Tshuvas. Now you could see it a little bit. This is a very important tshuva of Rav Moshe, written in 1978, where in 1978, so an incredible organization was formed, it was formed a little bit beforehand, called Hatzalah, Jewish Ambulance Corps. So what happened? Right? So what happened? So again, they asked Rav Moshe, they obviously need to figure out what are their protocol for Shabbos. What are the protocol for Shabbos? So they asked Rav Moshe, what could we do on Shabbos? What can't we do on Shabbos? So take a look. So if you look at the tshuva, so the title by letter A is Yotzu Lahatzil. Now remember, the notion of violating Shabbos to go and to save a life, that's easy. That's easy. That's obvious. Of course you could violate Shabbos to go ahead. And remember, if there's what we call pikuach nefesh, or there's a life-threatening situation, it's not just that you could violate Shabbos, it's that, remember, the laws of Shabbos are suspended. It's not considered Shabbos. You could do whatever you need to do. So the question is not responding to the call to save a life. Where does the question come up? After the call has been answered, can you come back home? So if you look at the title here, it's Yatzu Lahatzil. If they went out to go ahead and save a patient, Masai Mutarin Lachzer Limkoman. So now, are the volunteer people on Hatzalah permitted to come back home? So we ran out for the call. We rushed the patient to the hospital. The hospital is 5 miles away from my house. So again, I can't walk. It's a bad neighborhood. Can I go ahead and can I drive back from the hospital to my home on Shabbos? So Rav Moshe writes over here, and this is really very interesting. Rav Moshe writes by paragraph B. He says, listen to this. Hinei bedavar elu, shenis agdu b'New York u'Brooklyn. There is this group of people that got, like, Brooklyn is an entity unto itself. There's New York, and then there's Brooklyn. So there are a group of people who got together in New York and in Brooklyn, lechabur lahatzolas nefashos, and they saved, they created, again, an organization dedicated to saving lives. Basha shekama pavim ira bekan, she'uch l'se yisoa b'chesed Hashem yisbarachim merubin. Just listen to what he writes. He says, and now, Baruch Hashem, we live in a time where, thank God, we're affluent and we have money. In other words, Rav Moshe is saying, you know, what's interesting is, there weren't too many Jewish ambulance corps right throughout history. Why? Why? Because you need a lot of money, Baruch Hashem, to be able to support that. So thank God, again, our people, you know, in this country have experienced, again, an incredible period of affluence. So Moshe writes, Baruch Hashem, and thank God we try to use our newfound affluence in the right way. So we founded Hatzalah. So he goes on, he says, She'adam echad bein bebayis bein berechovos, posik milin shom. Person could, God forbid, stop breathing. Ukishimavian lo shama takeif mechel kamtsan, oxygen tank, the old mine kalim idrahamo ilan takeif mamish, huatzala gidola. So what happens? They administer first aid right there where the person is. Vyesh yoser lo tsarach, vyesh shemoil, ach yuchula havil rofim, beize beisholim. And sometimes, again, Hatzala can't necessarily take care of the person, but they're able to at least keep the patient stable until they're able to get them to a hospital where they can get full care. And we're talking about something where moments, seconds matter. He says, Ubeloze, Achavo, Rofi mi besacholim bate, Nimshach zman, Achekvar into Alas. Vadai davar gadolu v'yasha chelim v'kocham v'isparachom v'yasham v'isparach kolach haverim shnitz agdu le'asos inyone atzala ilu l'shem shemayim la'atzlich ma'asei atzala. So it gives them a bracha, right? They're doing wonderful things, incredible things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should take care of them, should reward them, should make them successful. Paragraph C. U'kishe'iru zeh b'shabes v'yom tov u'motzui gam she'iru shnayim u'shlosha b'meshach ha'shabes. Sometimes, again, things happen over Shabbos. Sometimes two or three calls over the course of Shabbos. Belelov yomo, at night and during the day. Hari vade lelech im mechal hachamtzan lemakom shenimtzacho latekif. Bein lemakom karov ma'od shatorach hushet. So he goes on. Ramosha says, again, like we said before, responding to the call, and Ramosha says, he says something very interesting. He says, a person might think, well, what happens if the call is right, is 2 blocks away? I can make it there on foot. And let's say, because it's New York, you could sometimes even make it there on foot faster than you can make it in your car, right? Rav Moshe says something amazing. He says, if you feel that by running to the call, you're going to be drained and you're not going to be able to treat the patient properly, you could even get in the car and go. Even if it's not going to save you time, but it's going to save you energy, and that will allow you to treat more effectively. Rav Moshe says, absolutely you can. Which again, so far that's not novel. Anything you need to do in order to save a person who is in a potentially, even potentially a threatening situation, you're permitted to do. Of course, the question comes up. Rav Moshe writes towards the end of paragraph C, what about coming home? Look at paragraph D. Aval ikar mashi yesh ladon, but the real question we have to try to analyze is, hu le'inyin ha'chazara lebeiso, mimakom achol lekishu makom rachok. V'esher lelech ragli, what about coming home? Well, let's say again the patient is too far, whatever. We took the patient to the hospital. The hospital is too far to be able to walk back home. Va'af im eino rochok kol kach aval hu balayla shiyesh lochosh leilich ragli mitad harotzchim shemetsuyin ata. So what happens? Or it's not so far, but it's a bad neighborhood. And to walk home at night puts myself in perilous risk. Uli shar sham kol ha-shabbos va'af rak zman godol ka'ad ayom. So Rav Moshe writes, and then what am I faced with? So what are you going to tell me? That I have to sit there the entire Shabbos? Let's say someone answers a call, someone Friday night, take a patient to the hospital. I can't get back on my own. I can't get back. I can't walk back. Again, all I can back is drive back. So, but I'm supposed to spend Shabbos in the hospital. So they asked Rav Moshe, what should we do in such a situation? So in paragraph E, Rav Moshe quoted an interesting Gemara. I actually put the Gemara on your sheet, but we'll just do it outside. The Gemara Maseches Beitza discusses that there are certain things that the rabbis permitted, what we called sofan mishum tchilasan. We permitted people to do certain things lest they come to avoid doing other things. For example, there's an interesting halacha that says like this, that normally you're not permitted to tan hides on Shabbos or on Yom Tov, right? You can't. Now, one of the things that obviously to actually tan the hide, we know you can't do, but one of the things that they used to do in the initial part of tanning hide is they would take the animal hide and you would, like, if you can imagine, like, you would put it down in your hallway. Why would you put it down in your hallway? Because people walk over it, and the walking over it, by definition, softens the hide. You would leave it there for a couple of days like that. So technically speaking, one is not permitted to do that on Shabbos or Yom Tov, because that's considered to be a form of tanning. So the rabbi said, but you can't do it on Shabbos, you can do it on Yom Tov. What were the rabbis concerned about? That if you don't put the hide out to be trampled upon immediately after the slaughtering of the animal, the hide becomes brittle, and ultimately, over time, just becomes unusable. Now, if you lose out on the hide, that represents a significant financial loss. So what will people do if they can't go ahead and put the hide out to be trampled on? What will they do on Yom Tov? Milchiks, right? Right, dairy, right? So they won't eat meat. I'm not going to shecht an animal. I'm not going to slaughter an animal if I know I'm going to lose out on the hide. So forget it. So I'll eat something else. I'll eat chicken. Or I'll eat something else. But no meat. Now remember, again, so you'll say to yourself, okay, so who cares? Now remember, it does matter because, first of all, again, remember in the times of the temple, so the act of eating meat, by definition, required bringing of sacrifices, karbanos. We don't want people to hold back on their karbanos. And meat, of course, if you like meat, represents simchas Yom Tov, enjoyment of Yom Tov. Therefore, Chazal said that on Yom Tov, because the act of putting out the hide is a rabbinic prohibition. If the rabbis make the prohibition, the rabbis could also choose to suspend the prohibition. So the rabbis said, on Yom Tov, you can go and you can put out the hide. Why? In order that you not refrain from slaughtering the animals and thereby diminish your enjoyment of the holiday and your bringing of sacrifices. That's the concept of hetiru sofan mishum tchilasan. The rabbis allowed you to do something at the end of the process in order that you not go ahead and abstain from doing something in the beginning. And the Gemara gives a couple of other examples as well. For example, the Gemara says that, you know, in the times of the Talmud, so what would happen is, days before refrigeration. So let's say, again, especially in diaspora communities where you already had 2 days of Yom Tov, so people needed to buy food over the course of Yom Tov. You needed to buy food without refrigeration. So what would happen? So shopkeepers would open up their stores, and people essentially would buy on credit. There would be no discussion of pricing, no discussion. You obviously have to trust the people whom you're doing business. People would come and take on Yom Tov, and they would go ahead and they would pay after Yom Tov. So what happened in Talmudic stores? So you had a storefront. The windows had shutters. Those shutters were taken off during the day and became tables. And the merchant put all the wares on the table. Technically speaking, it is rabbinically prohibited to return the shutters back to the windows. Why? Because rabbinically, that represents an act of building. So what was the problem? The problem is if you tell the merchants that they can't put the shutters back in the windows, what's going to happen? Right? They're just not going to open up. And again, who's going to be adversely affected if they don't open up? The general populace. Therefore, again, in that situation, the rabbis allowed the merchants to put the shutters back in the window. Why? Because we don't want them to abstain from selling their wares. So there's this concept that we allow someone to do something in order that they don't abstain from doing something that is necessary for the general, well, it could be individual or public good. So to make a very long story short, if you skip now to page 6, just you can see, by the way, you can see how Rav Moshe writes. So this tshuva begins on page 4. It's page 4, page 5, page 6. And here's a perfect, remember I told you before that you can't just like find the answer at the end. Look where the answer is nestled over here. It's in that paragraph F. In that paragraph F, right? It's not its own paragraph. It's not bolded. It's not highlighted. It's just kind of nestled there, out of the way. So Rav Moshe writes, She'im kein gam bahatzala zu. Sheberof ha-pamim ha-tzorach lishos yesh lahathir lachzorim ha-rechev kishen yachol ha-hasig nachri sholichin berechev af rak bishvil zeh sheish lachush l'sofon mishum tchilasan. So Rav Moshe Paskin, here is the issue. The issue is if you do not allow the Hatzalah members to come back home on Shabbos, then what's going to happen? They're not going to answer the call. So you imagine, you're the Hatzalah member, you're sitting at your table Friday night, Shabbos just started 5 minutes ago. The closest hospital is 7 miles away. So you know you're going to take the picture of the hospital, and then what's going to happen? You're going to be stuck there. So you're going to think to yourself, you know what? All right, look, you know what? Let me see who else is answering the call. Right before I jump up, let me see who else. Now, of course, remember, in these situations, every second matters. Or Moshe says, we want these individuals to jump up immediately. We don't want them to think about anything else except getting out to save the patient. And the only way to do that is how? To allow them to ultimately come back on Shabbos. Now, Moshe gives the caveat that driving yourself back is the last ditch effort, meaning that, of course, what we try to do first is try to get a Gentile to drive you back. That's why, for example, let's say Hatzalah here in Baltimore on Shabbos has a non-Jew who is on call. That, let's say, again, should they need to respond to a call, there's someone who's a physician who's there to drive them back, to drive the cars back. So, again, it's better not to have to rely on it, but should there be no available Gentile? Should there be no available Gentile? Rav Moshe Paskin, that the Hatzalah members are permitted to come back on Shabbos. Now remember, it's really twofold over here. It's number one, Rav Moshe says, first of all, it's good for them to be home because you never know how many calls come in over the course of a Shabbos, and you never know when they're going to be needed in order to answer. But more than that, Rav Moshe says that we have to, and there are other examples. Hatzalah is not the only member example of this. There are other halachic examples of this. We have to allow them to come home in order that they should be vigilant and zealous in answering the calls as they come in. Because if we don't let them come home, then by definition, not that they're going to ignore it, chas v'shalom, these are the most dedicated people one could possibly imagine, but it's human nature. They're going to think twice if it means being away from their family for the entire Shabbos. I'll show you something interesting. If you go back for just a moment to page 3. So this is from a wonderful book called Reb Moshe, The Life and Ideals of Hagaon Rav Moshe Feinstein. So this interest was put out in commemoration of Rav Moshe's 20th yahrzeit. So look what he writes. In the formative years of Hatzalah, this is number 8 on page 3, the world-renowned volunteer medical emergency services were Rav Moshe, who established halachic guidelines for responding to calls on Shabbos. At a meeting between Rabbanim and Hatzalah coordinators, a Rav suggested to Rav Moshe that he was being lenient with regard to Hilchos Shabbos. Because Rav Moshe allowed that, and this is referring to this. Rav Moshe allowed that all members to come back on Shabbos. To somebody, you're being lenient. Rav Moshe Rosen declared, I am not mekel. I am not lenient in Hilchos Shabbos, in laws of Shabbos. I am machmir in pikuach nefesh. Right? I am stringent when it comes to saving a life. A short time later, this is actually very beautiful. Rav Moshe sent a message to Rabbi Heshi Jacob, coordinator of the Lower East Side Hatzalah Division, asking if he could become an official member of Hatzalah. Rabbi Jacob asked Moshe's grandson, Rabbi Mordechai Tandler, to explain the request. Rabbi Tandler said, your work is pikuach nefesh, it's life-saving, and the Rosh Yeshiva would like to be a part of your work. Rabbi Jacob replied that as Hatzalah's supreme halachic authority, Rav Moshe was surely a member. Surely was a member. So my point over here is, what do you see from here? So again, remember, this is Rav Moshe, and this is also the other piece, that so often in the decision of major complex halachic issues, it's not just about mutter or aser, it's also weighing the impact of a decision. Meaning, it's easy to be machmir. In general, it's always easy to be machmir and to say, you can't. You can't, and the truth is, very often it's just safer to be machmir because you know you're not trespassing on anything. And many disagree with this pesach of Rav Moshe. But Rav Moshe also understood that as the, remember, not just as the scholar, but as the manhig, as the leader, he had to be attentive to the ramifications of his decisions. And ultimately, like he said, he's not being lenient with Hilchos Shabbos, but rather, again, he's being machmir with pikuach nefesh. Yes. Oh, so that's a very, so the answer is it's different. Meaning, when I say it's like it's not Shabbos, what I mean is like this. You know, a little while ago, you know, there's an amazing organization in Israel called Somet. So you're familiar with Somet, right? So they put the Shabbos microphone, you know, so they all this stuff. So Somet, when they first started coming out with these things, they came out with the Shabbos phone. They called it the gramophone. The gramophone. So essentially, without getting into the halachic technicalities of it, instead of let's say normally when dialing a phone, let's say for argument's sake, it's a biblical prohibition. This had a way of circumventing the biblical prohibition and ultimately only making it rabbinic, which in situations of need, you know, to violate a rabbinic prohibition is not the biggest deal in the world. So many, many poskim came out against it, and they said it's not necessary. It's not necessary because remember, who are they making it for? I mean, generally, they were making it for medical emergencies. If you have a medical emergency, you do not need a grama somet phone. If you have a medical emergency, then this is what I mean when I say it's not Shabbos. The laws of Shabbos are suspended. You don't have to dial, you know, with your knuckles or with your nose or with any other kind of shinoi. You pick up the phone, you dial the phone because the laws of Shabbos are suspended. Now that is true only when dealing with the acute situation. If, let's say, Rav Moshe is telling the Hatzalah member that he could drive home, he would try to employ as many deviations as possible. So technically speaking, so that's why, again, we try to have the Gentile drive him back. If there's not a Gentile to drive him back, if there's a Gentile that could start his car, a Gentile that could open the door. Again, if these are not available, he could do these things himself, but whatever way he could deviate from the norm, he would deviate the norm. But yes, on the way back, he does have to be somewhat conscious of the laws of Shabbos. So let me show you something else that's interesting. Turn to page, and again, I apologize, we're not really doing these justice. I'm really giving you just a little bit of a panoramic view, but you could just see how amazing these are. And this is really just a little bit of a sampling. Turn to page seven. So this is also quite interesting. And what I found so striking about this was Rav Moshe's sensitivity towards the individual. So look what he writes over here. So this again is in the fourth chelik, in the fourth section of Arach Chaim, Kuf Lamed Beis 132. Look what he writes, paragraph A. Bidvar ha'isha shetzvicha lisa b'shabes b'taxi l'hospital. All right, a lot of English words here. So a woman has to travel in a taxi to hospital, kedei laledes, to give birth. U'mifachedes lisa b'atzma. She doesn't want to go alone. So Rav Moshe writes, paragraph B. Bidvar ha'isha shetzvicha b'shabes lisa b'taxi l'hospital kedei laledes v'irotze shegam habal o ima yisu ima mishum shebazeh yesh la yisu v'daita. So a woman says, I need my husband to come with me, I need my mother to come with me. Why? What are they going to do for you, right? The mother's not a midwife and the husband is going to pass out, right? So you know, what exactly, I want them to be there with me. I want them to be there with me. So Rav Moshe writes, "Im yesh lahatir kimo hadlokas ner shemuter af kishein tzorech be'etzem rak mishum yisuvei daita." So Rav Moshe says, so the question now essentially is the husband or the mother of this woman who's giving birth or in labor, are they permitted to engage in malacha for the sake, ultimately, of making this woman feel better? This woman is in labor. Are they allowed to go with her to make her feel better? Again, they're not actively doing anything. They're not going to be a help in any type of measurable fashion, but they're going to give her what we call yishuv hadas, right? Inner tranquility, inner quietude. They're going to make her feel better. Peace of mind. So Moshe has something interesting that we have there seems to be a halachic precedent for this. Rav Moshe writes that if there's a situation where a woman is giving birth on Shabbos and the room is dim, and the woman in labor says, I want you to light a candle, I want you to light another candle, in order that the midwife should have better, more light, more illumination. And the midwife says, I'm good, I got this, right? Don't worry, I can do this literally with my eyes closed, I've done this, I don't need the extra light. So the halacha says that if the woman in labor says, I want the light, then you kindle the light. So Moshe says, well, maybe logic would say, what does that tell us? that if, remember, a woman in active labor is considered to be safek sakanas nefashos, that is considered to be an acute, potentially life-threatening situation. So the halacha seems to say whatever she needs to make herself feel better, even if the person, people administering her care say it's not necessary, you still do it. So maybe, based on that, you would say that her father and her mother could just come with her in the taxi. If that's going to make her feel better, let them come. So much on the other hand, light is objectively beneficial. Even if the midwife says, I don't need the light, I'm okay without the light, no one's going to say there's too much light, right? Or no one's going to say I work better under dim circumstances, right? Meaning the light is objectively beneficial. So maybe that's the case where the halacha permits malacha done for the woman. But if you can't demonstrate that what she's asking for is what we'll call measurably or substantially significant for her, then perhaps the husband or the mother should not be able to come with her. Look at paragraph D. He says, actually skip down to paragraph E. Aval miko mokom ledina. So Ramosha says, there would appear to me halachically that there's no reason why we should permit the husband or the mother to go, she's permitted to do malacha, because the, meaning a woman in active labor, because she's in active labor. But it doesn't seem that we should be permitted to allow the husband or the mother to do any kind of malacha, to ride with her in the taxi, when at the end of the day, they're not doing anything for her. But look what Rav Moshe writes, and this is amazing. Aval mikol makom ledina, kevan dematzinu bioledes, sha'alula lehistakin machmas pachad. But says Rav Moshe, you know, sometimes when a woman is in labor, so additional anxiety complicates things. It complicates things. Meaning, again, is the husband going to do anything substantive for her? No. Is the mother going to do anything besides hold her hand? Probably not. But says Rav Moshe, the one thing we don't want to do to a person is to exacerbate or amplify their anxiety when they're in a difficult time. Mihu sheyachol lismoch al chilukim b'chashash pikuach nefesh v'lachin. Therefore, if she says, she being the woman active, I am afraid to go alone, even though the doctor's on the phone with her, right? She used her Tzomet gramophone to go ahead and call the doctor, right? So even though she went and the doctor said, nothing to worry about, your contractions are 6 minutes apart, you have plenty of time, get in the taxi, I'll meet you at the hospital, everything's going to be fine. Nevertheless, yesh bazeh chashash pikuach nefesh v'tzorich habal o ha'em lisa'ima. So look at just what happened in this tshuva. This is amazing. So Rav Moshe went from essentially, if I'm constructing a halachic argument, so halacha would say that the only time we allow malacha for the woman who is in active labor is when you can demonstrate that what she's asking for has some type of benefit on her circumstances. Based on that, again, what does the presence of the father, or the husband, the presence of the mother do? Halachically, nothing. But emotionally, we know it does a lot. But emotionally, we know that if we amplify her anxiety, then ultimately, again, that places her in an even more precarious situation. So Moshe therefore says, not only can the husband or mother go with her, but they are obligated to do so. So you see what's amazing? So we go from a question of can they, to Rav Moshe saying, really, if you're just looking at this in pure abstract halacha, the answer would probably be no. But because we don't examine anything in pure abstract halacha, halacha always has to interface with human reality, psychological reality. The psychological reality of the situation is such that that woman needs the safety and security to know that her mother or that her husband is there, or both, whoever she needs. She needs an entourage, I'll take the entourage. Whatever it is, if that's what she needs to feel safe and secure in this precarious state, then halachically, that is what we are obligated to provide her with. So again, this is a simple tshuva, a very small one, as you could see. But what's amazing is, and Rav Moshe goes on to explain, he says, of course, it goes without saying that the situation we're dealing with over here is that there's no concern of her delivering in the taxi. Right? Again, if there's a concern that she's mamish in active labor and we don't know what's going to happen between now and the hospital, then of course the husband can say, okay, honey, good luck. I'll call you after Shabbos. You know, let me know. You know, obviously, it's not a good idea on many levels. But again, Rav Moshe says, even aside from that, even let's say the doctor said, there's nothing to worry about. You've got plenty of time. But if this is what she feels she needs, then halachically, Rav Moshe Paskins, that is what we are obligated to provide her. See, here again you see, and what's so beautiful about this Rav Moshe saying is that, and again, I keep on going back to this distinction between the scholar and the leader. The scholar possesses an incredible amount of knowledge. the leader understands how to apply that knowledge to humanity, or how to lace that knowledge ultimately with sensitivity towards the individual. And again, this is just a small example of that. Let me end off with one last tshuva, and this is quite interesting. If you turn to page 8, so this is also another one of Rav Moshe's more controversial tshuvas. You know, there is a big dispute about an Eruv in certain major cities. So we know an Eruv, so again, remember, on a biblical level, one is not permitted to carry an item between what we call a private domain and a public domain, right? The Rosh Hasharach, Yachid to Rosh Hasharabim, or for that matter, even Dalet Amos, 6 feet within a public domain. Now, the truth is, so let's say in our community, so what do? We put up an Eruv in order to allow carrying. Now, an Eruv essentially creates a halachic enclosure. Now, there's one very important caveat. You can't put up an Eruv anywhere. You can only put up an Eruv in a situation where there is a rabbinic prohibition to carry. Because an Eruv is a rabbinic mechanism, and therefore it could address rabbinic prohibitions. But if you have a place where there is a biblical prohibition to carry, meaning what we call a biblical Rosh Sarabim, a biblical public domain. What's the definition of biblical public domain? It's at least 16 amos wide. It's called about 40 feet wide. And it has at least 600,000 people that pass through it every single day. People. It doesn't have to be Jews. People. That is called the biblical Rosh Sarabim, a biblical public domain. And an Eruv cannot work in such a situation. So two of the most highly contested Eruvim on the Eastern Seaboard are the Eruv in Brooklyn, because in Brooklyn, again, you have Ocean Parkway. And Ocean Parkway, according to many opinions, satisfies the criteria for a halachic Rosh Sarabim, and Manhattan. Right? So Manhattan, again, and Manhattan, there are two Eruvim. There's a West Side Eruv and there's an East Side Eruv. The East Side Eruv is a little bit more hotly contested than the West Side Eruv, but in any event, they're both hotly contested. Rav Moshe came out against the establishment of an Eruv in Brooklyn as well as in Manhattan. That's why to this day, so really it's interesting that the only people who seem to rely on the Eruv in Brooklyn are many of the Hasidic sects, which is very interesting. But to this day, pretty much Moshe's position is still that which is usually accepted. And again, there are others who disagree, but that's how you find many people don't. There is an Eruv in Brooklyn, but you know, we're good Jews. We, you know, even if there's something we like not to hold like it. You know, so you know, there is one that's there, but at the end of the day, people don't hold of it, which is in line with Rav Moshe. So look what Ramosha, now again, we're not getting into the details of the technicalities of it, but let me show you something really interesting. So look what he writes over here, page 8, Simon Pei Test. Look what he writes. Im limchos biyadam akilim, la'asos ira b'Manhattan. So somebody asked Rav Moshe, should we make a macho? Should we object? There are people who want to make an Eruv in Manhattan, people who are using Eruv in Manhattan. Should we object strenuously to those who use the Eruv in Manhattan? Look what Rav Moshe writes, paragraph B. Hine bedavar Manhattan, hari be'arti ba'arichos b'sifrei egros Moshe, kol atzadim sheish lahakel v'sheish lahachmir. So Moshe says, you know, in an earlier response, I went through this whole discussion about the Eruv. I'm not going to go through it again. He says, v'hamaskar la'ani asdaiti, the Manhattan lo dummy lema shenagu lahakil b'shar makamos, v'im kein in biyadin lahatir neged ashito shasru, v'gam raya gedolim ashe b'yushalayim lo asu Eruv lahatir, v'lachin eini roa davar sheyesh sheyeshana da'ati bazeh. So Moshe says, look, what I said to you before is what I hold like now. Moshe says, you can't make an Eruv in Manhattan. Okay, done. But look what he writes, and this is amazing. Bless you. Aval ha'kvar amarti she'ein biyadeinu limchos biyad hamakilin. But nor should we object to those who are more lenient. U'kishi yitiknu hariyeh mutar le'ezer shitos gam heim rabbanim gedolim. Look, Ramosh, look, I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong, but there are great people who are behind it. There are rabbanim who support it. U'migim chebohem mechivan shesovrim lefiach ra'asam she'echolim latakim v'heim ru'yim l'hora. There are rabbis who support this Eruv, and they're Torah scholars, and they're individuals who advance good and cogent arguments. I don't agree with them. Many don't agree with them, but nevertheless, they are rabbanim, they're respected Torah scholars, and this is what they paskin. Aval ani ba'atzmi, look what he writes, aval ani ba'atzmi, eini yochel l'seyeh b'azeh, da'af shiye tikun l'gabe ilo ha'matatlin shamo tzimer shseyochet l'sham shelo kidib ha'tikun yarvichu shayokei miko makum halu'um hazeh yakilku l'gabe. So Moshe says, look, at the end of the day, again, I stand firm in my position that what? That I do not believe that an Erev should be constructed in Manhattan, and I do not believe that even if people construct an Erev, I do not believe that it's a kosher Erev. However, Aval Rabbanim Hasorim Shiesh Latakein Rishaim Lasos Kimoshem Sovrim. But there are other Rabbanim who disagree with me. There are others who have differences of opinion. They advance cogent arguments, even though, again, I don't agree with them. But at the end of the day, those opinions should be respected as well. And this, I think, is such a beautiful window into the personality of Rav Moshe. Here you have, again, I want to tell you something. The other, again, it's a fascinating halachic discussion in general about the Manhattan Eruv. And one thing is clear, which is that the rabbis who were behind, who supported this idea of creating an Eruv in Manhattan, none of them were of the caliber of Rav Moshe. Again, Talmidei Chachamim advanced cogent arguments, but you see how Rav Moshe cultivates a respect for the other. Again, had Rav Moshe felt that their arguments were false, he would have said so. He agrees that their arguments have merit. He doesn't agree with them. He doesn't support them. But yet what? He's able to respect them. And this, I think, is another hallmark of a great leader. That a great leader is able to accept differences of opinion. Now again, we all have to be on the same playing field, right? We all have to live within at least some semblance of the same framework. At least we're all, you know, kind of playing by the same set of rules. We speak the same common language. But it's okay if we disagree. And I'm going to have my position. And you're going to have your position. And Rav Moshe, I'm not going to bend on my position. I'm going to tell you what the halacha is. And I feel, if you ask Rav Moshe, are the people who use the Erev of Manhattan, are they doing something wrong? Rav Moshe would say, I believe the answer to that is yes. But yet, I have respect for the other opinions as well. I have respect for the other. I'm able to go ahead and be more expansive in my worldview and even accept the fact that there are opinions other than mine, not be disparaging to them, not be condescending to them, and be willing to accept that they exist, even if I myself do not go ahead and agree with them. So hopefully, so now we've seen, as we've gone through just a little sampling of these tshuvas, so you've seen a number of amazing things. First of all, we've seen the incredible depth and breadth of Rav Moshe's incredible knowledge. Everything, again, from medical ethics to ultimately to Eruvim and pizza. Let's not forget pizza. That was an important one as well. But hopefully what we've seen is the following. Hopefully we've seen that, first of all, again, that the great halachic posek, the great halachic leader, is one, first of all, who also can't only decide issues based on Torah knowledge, but also must be well-versed in the external, whether it's medical facts or other facts as well. That's number one. Number two, we see that the great halachic decisor must be an individual who is not just only concerned with the halacha, but must also be concerned with the needs and the issues and the plight of the individual. And number three, the great halachic decisor is the one who also realizes that there is room for other opinions. He may not agree with them. He may never see eye to eye with them. He may feel in his heart of hearts that they are dead wrong. But at the end of the day, again, I can be accepting enough and realize there's enough room for diversity of opinion. And here's the amazing part. You know, the amazing part is what Rav Moshe also demonstrates in that tshuva, is that you could be accepting of the other without at all eroding your own position, your own stance, and your own standards. I could say that you are entitled to believe what you believe, and you are entitled to practice what you practice. I'm not bending what I do. I hold very firmly to what I do. But there's enough room within the halachic framework for multiple opinions to exist. So good question, yes.
That narrowness in their decisions goes a lot further than whether you have to say mercy over people.
You're 100% right. I would even complicate it more, that the other interesting thing in the world in which we live is very often there are statements that are made in the name of great rabbis that those rabbis themselves never even said, but were inferred from something else. See, you're right. Again, the mantle of leadership is an awesome responsibility. And that's why, again, you know, what's amazing is, I think I mentioned this last year when we spoke a little bit more about the biography of Rav Moshe. You know that before Rav Moshe ever issued an end-of-life decision, right? People would call him with end-of-life decisions. You know, he would fast the day before, and he would spend the day, like, steeped in prayer, recognizing that there's an awesome responsibility in terms of deciding questions that have ramifications on people's lives. And you're right, there are some who say things that do not understand the full gravity of their words, or that people hang on their every single word, and it's true. They don't necessarily understand it. I don't, you know.
It's not that they don't understand the ramifications. They don't have the knowledge of the world to go along with their Torah knowledge to be able to make responsible decisions that so many will follow.
Right. It's possible. I don't know. I knowledge of the world is also a relative thing. How much knowledge of the world you need in order to make an informed decision will depend on who you ask, right? Depending on which stream of Judaism you affiliate with and which world you live in. But I don't know if you're right or wrong. All I could tell you is about Rav Moshe, because that's all I was asked to speak about tonight. That's all I'm going on record for tonight. Right? But again, at least from Rav Moshe, again, what I hope is, and I think this is part of the beauty of learning these tshuvas, learning this responsa, is you don't just learn interesting facts or interesting details, you gain a window into what it means to truly be a leader. So we should hope that in the merit. Yes, sorry.
And then balancing it halachically, whereas, and you said the breadth of a true leader is to be able to do that, and that there are leaders that can do a lot of damage because they don't have that quality that you're talking about, and I think that's what it's
right. Although I would just, the only thing I would just add to that is, remember, the danger is on the opposite side as well. Is that you have many leaders that, let's say, will only make decisions based on the humanity piece without much regard for the halachic piece. So meaning I'm saying, you're right, anytime you go to an extreme, you're always going to have danger. And that's, again, and that's why, and I just want to point out, that's why if you'll notice, there aren't too many Rav Moshes. Right, these type of personalities are a once-in-a-generation type of person who is able to literally be in both worlds, master both worlds, and yet compromise neither.
The other thing I gather from all of this, since my Hebrew is extremely erudite, and I didn't understand anything except the word Manhattan.
and cars. Cars. Hospital.
Saving a life precludes everything. That the idea of preserving Shabbat, what does preserving Shabbat mean? So if it means preserving Shabbat by breaking Shabbat for a positive purpose, that's what you need to do. And but everything is for a positive grounding.
Right.
That's what I'm hearing you say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Correct. Again, you know, Rav Moshe operated, you know, there's a very important principle that the Talmud often states. The Talmud explains that Dirachecha Darchei Noam, the ways of the Torah are pleasant. And I always say, you know, a very important idea to understand that if there's something in your Judaism that's unpleasant, chances are you're doing it wrong or it's been explained wrong. But Judaism is here to enhance our life. It's not here to hinder, to handicap, or to any way make us miserable. And I think Rav Moshe clearly shows us that the halacha is so in sync with what we need as people, with what we need as human beings, not what we need as Jews. That's the beautiful gift. So we should be privileged in Mirat Hashem coming together, like everyone did tonight, learning, really. the beautiful tshuvas of Rav Moshe that we should see. I think the major take-home message is that the beauty of our Torah and the beauty of our Judaism is that, as you just mentioned, it's so compatible with every aspect of who we are, that sometimes we think we have to make a choice between adhering to the tenets of our faith and yet being worldly or being contributing members of society. And the beautiful part is our Judaism only helps us grow in every way, in every area. And just like Rav Moshe used his Judaism and used his knowledge of halacha to really further the human condition and further the human cause and enrich people's lives, we should be privileged to do the same. All right.